Today on Vox Talks Economics, six fixes for central banks. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. Does the way that central banks are structured and the way they operate obscure the true fiscal health of the state, even pose risks for the wider economy? That's what Willem Bouter, former chief economist at Citigroup, former member of the MPC of the Bank of England, amongst other things, seemed to argue in a presentation to the IMF's Institute for Capacity Development in January. Willem joins me now to explain why central banks may have issues and what we might do about it. Willem, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you.
You described central banks in this presentation and in the paper that comes from it as agents of the state. And we think of them as operationally independent. So why did you choose that description?
Well, it's important to recognize that the state, basically the central government in almost every case, is the beneficial owner of the central bank. They get their profits. Second, the government sets the mandate of the central bank through legislation. In some cases, they don't just give the general mandate, like price stability or healthy growth for employment, but they give a specific number. In the UK, the inflation target is set by the Treasury, not by the central bank. And in addition, of course, central banks do lots of operational management for the government. They manage foreign exchange rate in most countries, in the US, for instance, and they manage the checking account of the government. So there's no doubt that they are, even if they have some operational independence for monetary policy, they are part of and agents of the state.
Now, given that, the first risk that you point out is that the ownership structures of these banks, these agents of the state, can be misleading. Which central banks are we talking about here?
We're not talking about the Bank of England here.
Right.
Before 1946, they were privately owned, which was crazy, but since 46, owned by the Treasury. But we're talking about the Fed, which, while the Board of Governors is an independent federal government agency, the 12 regional reserve banks, Federal Reserve Banks, that have all the assets and the liabilities are owned by the private member banks. So technically, it looks like a private entity. The Bank of Japan, 50% privately owned. Swiss National Bank, more than 50% of the shares controlled by the government and about 77% of the voting shares, but there are still domestic and foreign private owners. The Banca d'Italia is technically 100% privately owned, even though they can't pay more than 6% of the capital of the bank in dividends to the shareholders. And there are others, the National Bank of Belgium, the Bank of Greece. It's a long, unfortunate list.
Now, I was always taught that the devolved structure of the Fed was to ensure that it was operationally independent, that it wasn't subject to institutional capture by Washington, D.C. or New York. Is that not the case?
No. The ownership structure of the Federal Reserve Bank, the regional Federal Reserve Banks, does nothing to safeguard the central bank from government pressure or even for outright government takeover of its operations. It is just really confusing and unnecessary nonsense.
You also mentioned there's a problem with how some central banks also deal with losses. Governments get the profits. I thought that they always just covered the losses as well for central banks.
No, here, again, the Bank of England and the UK are in the good camp. There is a profit and loss sharing arrangement for the asset purchase facility. That's operational losses only, not mark-to-market losses. All profits go to the Treasury. All losses get compensated by the Treasury. And in addition, there is an income sharing and recapitalization agreement between the Treasury and the Bank of England. If its capital falls below a certain threshold, the Treasury will restore it to a significantly higher level. So Sweden has the same kind of compensation arrangement. But many central banks don't. Again, the Fed does not. There is in the Federal Reserve Act a statement that the profits go to the Federal Treasury, but there is not a word said about what happened to the losses. And many other central banks are in the same position.
What happens to the losses then?
They just reduce the central bank's capital, and they can end up with significantly negative capital. Now, because some of their liabilities, in fact, most of the liabilities, often central bank money, this does not threaten, in general, their solvency, because they can always print more if the debts involved are domestic currency denominated. If you have a lot of foreign currency denominated debt, the central bank can indeed go bust. And some central banks, emerging markets, have done so. We are not in that position in any of the advanced economies, but the losses have been huge, and more may come, especially in countries like Japan, where rates are still extraordinarily low, and the central bank has a balance sheet of more than 100% of annual GDP. But these losses, as I said, simply reduce the net worth of the central bank.
You also had concerns about whether central bank money is really a liability. So I looked this up in the Bank of England's weekly report, and on paper, it is there. It is listed as a liability. Why is this a problem?
It's not a problem. It is simply, as I said, my answer to what happens when the central bank has deep losses. They can always, if they have domestic currency losses, get out of it by printing more money. Because money, well, legally, a liability, central bank money, currency, and checking accounts with the central bank, they are not any meaningful economic sense a liability because they are irredeemable. A £20 note only gives you the right to go to the central bank and say, give me a £20 note, or maybe two £10 notes. So it is a claim only on itself. So it's not a meaningful liability. And that has to be recognized because of the reason why central banks can have deeply negative equity without being insolvency. Of course, the amount of money they may have to issue to stay solvent, to meet obligations, may not be compatible with price stability. That's a real issue. And if the government, the beneficial owner, has the resources, it should maintain the central bank's ability to target inflation effectively by recapitalizing the central bank, compensating it for losses that threaten its ability to target inflation as it should.
So what you seem to be saying is that these conventions for the way that central banks operate and record their operations, they give a false picture of the economy in some cases?
We certainly should always, when we look at the solvency, the balance sheet of the state, put the central bank in with the central government and the general government. And then that means that the holdings by the central bank of government bonds net out, they disappear. They're assets of the central bank, liability of the treasury. You consolidate these accounts as you should, they disappear. And instead, the state, the consolidated state, including central bank, now has monetary liabilities, which do not create solvency issue, but may potentially create an inflation issue. And that is how central banks and governments have to think about their balance sheets.
In December 2024, we spoke to Frank Ilderson, member of the executive board of the ECB, to ask how central banks should respond to climate change. Listen to what he has to say in our episode, Can Central Banks Green the Financial System?
Now, one very interesting thing that you argued in this paper is the need to remove the effective lower bound. But haven't the European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank, haven't they already gone there with negative interest rates?
No. They have had negative interest rates, minus 75 basis points for the Swiss National Bank. I think the Danes did a minus 60. The ECB on its deposit account had minus 50 basis points. That is the lower bound. So the effective lower bound is zero lower bound. And that is because the return on holding money is not zero, but it's slightly negative because there is the carry cost of currency, storage, safekeeping, maybe insuring against loss or theft. So the effective lower bound is not zero. I think it is around 75 basis points, probably. But I want to see if that minus 75 basis point, if that's the effective lower bound, is abolished and give the central banks, if necessary, for cyclical stabilization reasons, to set deeply negative rates, minus 3%, minus 4%, instead of the current limit of minus 75 or minus 50 basis points.
Yes, we created all sorts of tools to work at or around the lower bound, things like QE. What would we need to do? What innovation would we need to make if we eliminated the effective lower bound instead?
The effective lower bound is eliminated by abolishing currency, zero interest currency, right? You get rid of cash and currency and you replace it with a retail central bank digital currency that can be used not just for online transactions, but also for offline transactions, money on the card that you can tap in a store and the money gets transferred, and also that should have no limits, no caps on the size of the accounts and size of the transactions. Unfortunately, central banks, including the ECB and the Fed, have committed themselves not to get rid of currency because it's a politically sensitive issue. And so they basically are going to be stuck with this zero, the effective lower bound. And the next time inflation is below target and the economy is in recession, we will again have to use not the deeply negative interest rates, which are not available, but large-scale asset purchase quantitative easing by the central bank to try and stimulate demand. And that's an ineffective and, in my view, quite dangerous tool to use.
And you think we will be back in this situation again?
I don't think we are at risk of being there in the near future. But it certainly is possible. Remember, what people call the neutral real interest rate, which is the real interest rate that would balance aggregate demand and aggregate supply at target inflation and a sustainable current account deficit, is that real interest rate is now thought by many economists to be low, sometimes 0.5% or between 1.5%. And since the inflation target at 2%, neutral interest rate may be no more than 2.5% or 3%. And it's certainly possible that we will get a series of adverse shocks the way we had following the great financial crisis 2008-2009, that we get a shock like that, which will put inflation below target, unemployment above the full employment level, and therefore creates a need for significant additional stimulus, which may not be possible without putting the interest rate well below the current effective lower bound.
Now, clearly reading this paper, you are very concerned about the prospect of fiscal dominance, especially in the US. Why, in theory, should fiscal dominance be a bad thing?
Fiscal dominance means that central banks purchase government assets, government bonds, and set rates at levels that are low to meet the government's financing need, even if this is inconsistent with their price stability mandate. So the central bank should, unless there's the threat of a major financial crisis, be able to say no to the government when it's asked to fund and monetize a significant amount of government debt, should be able to say no and not be sent into the wilderness. That is what operational independence means. Now, it's difficult to guarantee that. It can only be secure, the ability to resist fiscal dominance, if there is widespread political support for low inflation, and if it is recognized that low inflation requires the central bank to be able to say no to government requests for funding its debt.
So how does fiscal dominance play out, especially in the US, looking at the sorts of policies that President Trump is likely to pursue? What bad outcomes do we get from fiscal dominance day to day?
I don't think we are going to have what I would call fiscal dominance through brute force. The president simply fires all the members of the board of governors that don't do what he wants them to do, and that way acquires a majority of the voting members of the FOMC, the Open Market Committee, that makes the decision on monetary policy. I don't think that's likely.
No.
There are regularly crazy proposals in the U.S. Congress, mostly in the House, to change the mandate of the central bank. I hope that's also unlikely. Price stability, maximum employment, and moderate long-term interest rates will remain the monetary policy targets. Now, the way fiscal dominance can occur, even when the central bank is independent and the government is telling what to do, is if large-scale purchases of sovereign debt of a magnitude inconsistent with medium and long-term price stability is required to prevent a great financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a possibility. The U.S., our federal debt, is about 100% of GDP. We have to take out the bit that's owned by the central bank, so it's not quite that high. But it's not only, I think, high by historical standards, the highest peacetime debt that we've seen, but it's also rising very fast. The unsustainable deficits started by Biden, and which are likely to be continued by Trump, who is more likely to get his proposed tax cuts through the Congress than the spending cuts that he and Mr. Musk are after. So I think that the debt may become unsustainable. And if through that a debt default threatens, which in the US can also happen technically because the debt exceeds the level permitted under the debt limit restraint. This is a silly rule in the US that requires this Congress to make sure that the government debt stays below a limit, which has been changed, I think, 60 times in the 1960s, but it's still always a risk. So there is a risk of technical default or even a substantive default by a fiscally unsustainable U.S., in which case the central bank is faced with the dilemma, do I let the sovereign default play out, which would create havoc globally because the dollar remains the dominant global reserve currency, accounting for more than 50% of global foreign exchange reserves. They have a choice between that or purchasing and monetizing the excessive federal government debt and therefore giving up on its inflation target because its financial stability mandate, which is the true primary mandate of every central bank, even if the law doesn't say so, in the end, trumps the price stability mandate if there is a conflict between the two, even with operationally independent central banks.
There is just one further thing from your lecture that I'd like to discuss, and that is your argument that the fiscal theory of the price level is flawed. Now, for non-economists, and I would imagine for some economists as well, what is the fiscal theory of the price level? What is the flaw with it?
It asserts that if there is nominal government debt outstanding, there is no need to worry about insolvency, no matter how much of it is outstanding, because the price level will always take on the value to make the real stock of government debt consistent with the future surpluses the government and the central bank can generate to service their debt. The reason it matters, not just in academia, is that it can cause unjustified relaxation about sovereign debt sustainability. Technically, what they do is they turn budget constraint, which holds identically, into an equilibrium condition, add an equilibrium condition to a model, you have to add another endogenous variable. If you don't, you get an overdetermined system. And that's the case for the physical ceiling and the price level, unless the price level is perfectly flexible and the authorities set the nominal interest rate. In that case, we have what is called nominal indeterminacy in the regular economic models with physical ceiling and the price level, have a fully determined system. The problem is that this price level can do crazy things. It can be negative. If you happen to have foreign currency debt, index-linked debt only, this is not going to work. And why should the price level take on the value to allow the government to satisfy its intertemporal budget constraint and to value its debt at a price that has no default risk in it? Why not Mrs. Jones? Right? There are lots of budget constraints. So it is a theory that is a logical nonsense. That's one reason why it should not be taught or taken by politicians. But it's also dangerous if policymakers were to believe it, because it says, don't worry, the real stock of debt will adjust without any discounts for default risk to satisfy your intertemporal budget constraint. I know I've used some technical language here, and I'm sorry about that, but there's no way to avoid that. This is, as I said, a dangerous, logical nonsense proposition, which fortunately no central banks or governments have taken on board, but we should make sure that this remains the case.
Yes, you did give the qualifier, if policymakers choose to believe it. You've been in the room when policy has been made. It sounds like it's not taken into account when policy is being set.
To the best of my understanding, and just reading the minutes of many central banks, global central bankers, no, this theory does not play a role in central bank decision-making.
Well, long may that be the case. Okay, Evelyn, we've had six areas there where you would like to see some change, some reform, some rethinking. If policymakers, governments don't take any action, don't do anything about any of these, how big is the risk? What is the risk?
Well, there is a risk that we will get fiscal dominance through brute force. Governments simply forcing the central bank to monetize its debt or to keep interest rates at too low a level, either through pressure or by changing the composition of the decision-making body in a way that gets the central bank to act in the way the government wants. And so avoiding fiscal dominance through brute force or through changes in the central bank mandate that inconsistent with full employment and price stability is the first thing. Then I think it's very important that central banks treat profit and losses for the central bank symmetrically, and that they stand ready to recapitalize central banks, provided their solvency is not threatened by this, if central banks make large losses. And then I think the abolition of the effective lower bound should be done as soon as possible, so that when, maybe if, we enter another episode of extraordinarily low inflation and weak economic activity, we can set rates at a deeply negative level rather than having the central bank engaging in massive asset purchases, which, in my view, encourage financial instability and bubbles. So those are the three things governments, I think, should do as soon as possible.
You know people who are involved in the governance of central banks, who are policymakers. Do they share your concerns?
I know of no central bank that would be willing to abolish the effective lower bound by getting rid of currency. In fact, not only have central banks that have spoken out on this issue said that they will not abolish currency, but they have said that they will not pay interest on any central bank digital currency that they may issue, and they impose caps on the size of the accounts individual account holders can hold. This means that we are going to be stuck with the effective lower bound, even when in the next crisis, deeply negative interest rates would be the optimal policy response. I do think that fiscal dominance through brute force is not likely, but it is a risk, especially in the US, where the president can fire any member of the Federal Reserve Board, quote, for cause, unquote. For cause is not specified. If the president were to fire the head of the central bank or any other of the board members, then the courts would have to decide what for cause means. And that's always a risky business, because the courts tend to be, on the whole, short of monetary theorists.
Let us hope that central banks and governments, for whom they act as agents, are responsive to some of these concerns. Willem, thank you for talking about them.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The discussion paper is called Central Banks as Fiscal and Financial Agents of the State. It is discussion paper 19947 and at CEPR if you want to look it up that way.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. Next week, what happens when populists expel the experts? Thank you.